ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 31st of October. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the UN condemns the US announcement to recommence testing nuclear weapons. And how's your impression of a kookaburra or a black cockatoo? Is it as good as these young, competitive bird callers?
It's lovely, and I wish more schools would be able to do it. I think they're very lucky that they have to have it. They must have a teacher, obviously, who's interested in nature.
Prince Andrew will be stripped of his royal title as his fall from grace over his ties to the convicted sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein continues. King Charles has also ordered the disgraced royal vacate his 30-room mansion and move to private accommodation. The move by the monarch is seen as a severe but necessary action to protect the reputation of the royal family. Oliver Gordon has more.
King Charles has stripped his younger brother Andrew of his title of prince and forced him out of his Windsor home in a move Londoners have mostly welcomed.
He's meant to be the face of England. Is this what we represent? Is this what the people represent? No, it's a disgrace. So I'm happy he's got stripped of his titles.
It's a bit of an embarrassment, to be honest, on the nation, on the country, everyone in general. This is a member of our royal family. These are our leaders.
I think fair enough for the royal lodge because, you know, it looks far too big for someone of his stature. But I mean, I'm a bit concerned for him because what's the toll on him and the impact on his health?
Polls show the royal family has been losing the support of younger generations for years. King Charles, with the support of his 43-year-old son William, has acted to protect the institution. Royal expert and former BBC royal correspondent Jenny Bond.
By any measure, this is quite a ruthless decision. Clearly, the palace are determined to put a line under all that's happened.
The move comes after years of pressure over the former prince's relationship with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In recent weeks, emails emerged showing he'd remained in contact with Epstein longer than he previously admitted. That news was followed by publication of a posthumous memoir by Epstein accuser Virginia Giuffre, who alleged she had sex with Andrew when she was 17. Giuffre died by suicide in Western Australia in April at the age of 41. Her memoir, released this month, detailed three alleged sexual encounters with Andrew. The crescendo of incidents led to members of the British public heckling King Charles on the street. Jenny Bond again.
With only one man, but it was loud, saying, "What did you know about Andrew and when?" I mean, this was clearly a problem that was not going to go away. And now, well, in the words of the family of Virginia Giuffre, an ordinary American girl has brought a British prince down.
Andrew, 65, has long denied Virginia Giuffre's claims. Andrew was the younger brother of King Charles and the second son of the late Queen Elizabeth. Stripped of all his titles, he'll be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
This is an extraordinary... Now, I've been reporting on the royals for 35 years, and this is the most extraordinary night I can remember. I mean, on a par with almost anything, even including Diana's death.
The decision to force Andrew to move away from the Royal Lodge in Windsor follows reports in the British press he'd not paid rent on his 30-room mansion for two decades. In a rare political intervention into the workings of the royal family, a British parliamentary committee this week questioned whether Andrew should still be living in the house. Andrew is expected to move to a property on the King's Sandringham estate. Royal commentator Juliette Reardon.
Now, that's crucial because the Sandringham estate is not Crown estate property, so there is no connection to the public purse. This is private property owned by the King. The King is not going to tell us which property he will be moved into, but there are an awful lot of cottages on the Sandringham estate where Andrew could live.
A statement released by Buckingham Palace concludes with the line, "The King and Queen's thoughts have been and always will be with the victims and survivors of any and all forms of abuse." Juliette Reardon again.
I think Queen Camilla would be behind this as well as the King. Queen Camilla works in areas with vulnerable women.
Andrew was once regarded as a dashing naval officer and served in the military during the Falklands War. Now, at least publicly, he's all but banished. It's not the first time the royal family has taken drastic action to protect its reputation. University of Sydney historian Sidney McCreary recounts an episode in 1936 when Edward VIII abdicated just over a year after ascending the throne so he could marry divorced American socialite Wallis Simpson.
He did retain a new title of Duke of Windsor, but he was no longer considered a prince. And these are all consistent with the British royal family's determination to secure the future of the monarchy.
The historian says this intervention by King Charles should be viewed in this context.
This action is taken by Charles to secure and to show William and George that he's doing all he can to keep the monarchy supported and to be supported in Britain and around the world.
University of Sydney historian Cindy McCreary ending Oliver Gordon's report. Donald Trump's announcement that America will resume testing nuclear weapons has raised global anxieties and even sparked a United Nations rebuke. The UN says nuclear testing can never be permitted. Donald Trump believes other nations are testing and says the US should follow suit, marking a radical deviation from the nation's long-standing policy. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
US President Donald Trump has arrived back on home soil after his whirlwind Asia trip.
Are you going to negotiate with Democrats to end the shutdown, sir?
While he landed to questions about the state of domestic politics, comments the president made mid-air are continuing to spark international attention.
They seem to all be nuclear testing. Russia? We have more nuclear weapons than anybody. We don't do testing. We've halted it many years ago. But with others doing testing, I think it's appropriate that we do also.
Donald Trump suggesting the US would simply be following suit, but he reiterated the goal is still non-proliferation.
But I see them testing. I say, well, if they're going to test, I guess we have to test. I'd like to see a denuclearization.
The comments doubled down on an earlier post on his Truth Social platform. Dmitry Peskov is the spokesman for Russian President Vladimir Putin and offered a swift response.
Indeed, there is a current moratorium in place. In his statement, President Trump mentioned that other countries are allegedly conducting nuclear weapons tests. Until now, we haven't been aware of anyone carrying out such tests.
He says if someone abandons the moratorium, Russia will act accordingly, and wanted to clarify Russia's recent tests of nuclear-powered missiles Poseidon and Burevestnik.
We hope that President Trump was correctly informed about it. There is no way it can be interpreted as nuclear testing.
The UN reacted to the announcement from President Trump, saying current nuclear risks are already alarmingly high. Farhan Haq is the deputy spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General.
We must never forget the disastrous legacy of over 2,000 nuclear weapons tests carried out over the last 80 years, and that nuclear testing can never be permitted under any circumstances.
Experts say a resumption of nuclear testing would open a Pandora's box. Dennis Wilder is a senior fellow for the Initiative for US-China Dialogue on Global Issues at Georgetown University.
We all have to admit that Trump's ability to use language with specificity is a little bit of a shortcoming. I don't think he was actually talking about nuclear weapons explosions. I think he was talking about the delivery systems. So I would be very surprised if the United States is going back to nuclear testing.
But today, Vice President J.D. Vance didn't attempt to water down the comments.
It's an important part of American national security to make sure that this nuclear arsenal we have actually functions properly, and that's part of a testing regime. To be clear, we know that it does work properly, but you got to keep on top of it over time.
Dr. Christopher J. Watterson is a research fellow with the Foreign Policy and Defence Program at the United States Studies Centre in Sydney. His research focuses on nuclear non-proliferation.
Ostensibly, Trump is referring to full explosive testing, which the United States hasn't done since the 1990s. Obviously, this would be very significant. A resumption of US nuclear testing would signal a declining confidence in the global non-proliferation regime. It would potentially begin a vicious cycle of testing and nuclear arms racing between Russia and China.
How concerning do you think all of this is?
It's quite significant in terms of regional security dynamics. It signals that the fragile balance of nuclear deterrence that exists between the major powers is starting to become a little more unstable. It also suggests that global support for the non-proliferation regime amongst the major powers is now starting to wane, and that's likely to have knock-on effects for international perspectives toward nuclear weapons. It's likely to push nuclear weapons back to the forefront of international security agendas, which will increase demand for nuclear weapons in aspiring states.
Dr. Christopher Watterson there from the United States Studies Center, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Well, a like-minded community of outsiders, the end of a dirt road, parallel societies living outside of state authority. All over the world, rural enclaves united by extremist views are increasingly popping up. And if the recent police shootings here in Australia, Weambla and Porepunkha, have shown anything, it's that these shy communities should be ignored at our peril. Dr. James Patterson is from the School of Social Sciences at Monash University and is a Lowy Institute Research Associate. And he's been looking at some of these communities. He joined me earlier. James, the idea of a socialist commune or a rural collective was pretty popular in the 60s and 70s and is not new on the left. But what we are seeing now is the far-right equivalent, with victimhood or resistance from the state, sometimes violently, the common threads. My question to you is why? Why are we seeing this now?
One very important aspect to think about here is that these communities are basically a rejection of mainstream society. As you noted, some of them reject specifically state authority. Now, some of these communities are also more openly anti-immigration or, to a certain degree, more openly racist, and they label themselves specifically as a white-only community. But the through line here is, as you noted, this is a rejection of mainstream society, and they portray themselves as an alternative to the perceived illegitimacy of that mainstream society. So that's really the crux of it here, right? Why they're establishing the community. They feel as though mainstream society has in some way failed. On that front, I think a very important question to also ask is, why are they seemingly growing in attractiveness? We have to understand that radicalization, or what pushes an individual towards joining these communities, can be a highly idiosyncratic, highly individualized process. But a common thread here are perceptions of individual alienation, individual marginalization, where an individual feels as though society has in some way failed them, right? And that can lead to those individuals seeking an alternative. And as these communities portray themselves as an alternative, that can gather attractiveness or gather individual supporters to join these communities.
Are these individuals from these remote communities, or are they city dwellers that may have become disaffected for whatever reason in the big smoke and have headed to places where they can conduct their business perhaps with more privacy?
Yeah, that's quite an interesting dynamic that's happening. We're kind of seeing a bit of both. On one hand, we are often seeing these communities pop up as individuals retreat from our urban societies. But we're also seeing that once they've established themselves within these more rural communities or rural enclaves, that they seek to actually spread the tendrils out, so to speak, into the existing rural communities.
What can be done? What's being done overseas to try and stitch these types of societies back into the mainstream?
It's quite an interesting question. We are seeing this global trend emerging. So most communities and most countries are grappling with the right way to respond to it. To me, the key to addressing some of these concerns is to strengthen rural resilience rather than securitize it. Rather than seeing rural communities as an arena for potential extremism, we should understand the vulnerabilities that may be making it so. So one of the things we might be doing here is, you know, stitching rural communities back into what are historically urban-focused policies and programs, whether that's in the countering violent extremism lens or more generally. At the most basic, it could look something like supporting local police officers with training. So they have an awareness of these trends, and then they can spot it, they can report it, and making sure there are links for these urban, or so these more rural police into urban environments. But it can also look like broader rural buildup. Right. So this could look like building infrastructure, or it could be connectivity programs, or maybe even basic health services, both mental and physical health. The goal here would be to ensure that we support rural communities and that we indicate that these rural communities are not left behind. They are connected, they are confident, and they feel valued.
Dr. James Patterson is from the School of Social Sciences at Monash University and is a Lowy Institute Research Associate. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Forced labour, trafficking and passport theft might sound like crimes that happen in other parts of the world, but reports of modern slavery in Australia have surged in the last financial year. The New South Wales Anti-Slavery Commissioner says the number of people who've reported being victims of modern slavery in the state has risen by more than 100%. Joanna Carruthers has the story.
Moe Turaga still remembers the pain of being exploited on an isolated farm in the middle of Victoria decades ago.
Oh, look, the trauma doesn't go away.
Mourning the death of his father and just 17 years old, he left Fiji on the promise that he could make money in Australia that would be sent back to his family. The reality of what happened was very different. He was a victim of what's now been identified as modern slavery.
Little did we know that, for 2.5 years that we worked, none of the monies went to our families, which broke our heart.
Bad memories of the tough horticultural work 7 days a week have also lingered, even though the physical wounds have healed.
Anyone that works in horticulture will understand or will know that it is hard work. We've been isolated and my mum was quite elderly and she had to go out and find work for the two younger siblings.
Since Moe's experience in the late 80s, the New South Wales Commissioner of Anti-Slavery says progress has been made, but there are still major gaps in legislation. Temporary migrant workers make up half the number of calls from victims to the state's reporting hotline. Commissioner James Kikane says New South Wales has the strongest anti-slavery system in the country, but perhaps the weakest licensing system for businesses which hire temporary workers like cleaners and farmhands, meaning their actions can fly under the radar.
We've been getting calls through our hotline from workers cleaning city offices, workers on regional farms and students at our universities who are being deceptively recruited, trapped in debt bondage, pushed into forced labour and trafficked by dodgy labour hire companies.
He believes some of those companies are moving from Victoria and Queensland to New South Wales to take advantage of the non-existent licensing regime.
Ideally, we would like to see a national labour hire scheme. But if that's not possible, then we would urge New South Wales to immediately put labour hire regulation in place.
Professor Justine Nolan is the director of the Australian Human Rights Institute. She says when Australia passed the Modern Slavery Act in 2018, the nation was ahead of the game.
Since that time, we've been stagnating, both in terms of regulation, government action, but also there's a sense of many businesses sort of focused on compliance and not really addressing the root cause of the issues.
But now she wants to see the federal act strengthened.
We need to bring in penalties and we need to make it mandatory that companies have to not only report, but really take action.
Commissioner James Kikane says 34,000 frontline workers are receiving modern slavery training, and there's been improvements to the protections for vulnerable workers in the textiles and cleaning sectors.
Joanna Carruthers. We live in a rapidly developing digital age when kids are increasingly likely to play video games as a social activity. The National Inter-Schools Competition for Esports, which is called the Fuse Cup, is gaining popularity. Young people from right across southwestern New South Wales recently gathered to take part in the Riverina Heat for the comp. Nicola Saccato was there.
In a theatre once home to social dances and movie premieres, a different kind of social connection is forming. High school students from across the Riverina in southern New South Wales are trying their luck in the Fuse Cup, an esports competition in Leeton's Roxy Theatre.
You see some kids, they sit out during sport and they don't like to do it, and then you bring them here to an esports competition and so much good stuff for them. Like, they really enjoy it.
14-year-old Fergus Steers goes to an ag college nearby and is excited for the opportunity to show what he's made of.
It feels good to prove to people that in the city that, yeah, the bush kids can play. It's not always the city kids are the best. Sometimes there are good hidden gems from the country, so.
The winner of the day's event will head to the finals on the Gold Coast in mid-November, but organiser Kristen Cummins says it's about far more than beating each other in Mario Kart.
The kids are always going to find a way to play this kind of stuff, so it's better to encourage and support them and actually be aware of what's going on more than what it is to just completely cold turkey it.
Throughout the entire competition, the Fuse Cup puts competitors through digital wellbeing seminars, so teens are playing safely at home or online and know where to go if they need help.
It can be anything based around cyberbullying, about if a stranger approaches you online, and different things as well, like image-based abuse and making sure that everybody is aware of what is going on online.
Organiser Kristen Cummins says it's about empowering kids to make the right choices, rather than banning something they enjoy out of fear.
You're not going to have a strong bond or relationship with youth if you are just taking everything away from them.
It's a strategy Charles Sturt University's Doctor of Psychology, Rachel Hogg, says works well when it comes to engaging with kids.
Particularly for boys, but also for neurodiverse young people, gaming can be a really fruitful way of finding safe social connections that they might not necessarily be achieving outside of the gaming context. Mention neurodiversity, but generally kids with disabilities often find a lot of social connection in these contexts and a kind of a sense of community. And I think that's what this is about at the end of the day. And a lot of the time, what's attractive about that online environment is that there's a level of control around it as well.
16-year-old Jack Curry from Leeton High School has been crowned the Mario Kart champion of the Riverina.
The first time I made it, so found a tournament, and I'm really stoked to follow through. And
if I'm going to national, I need to at least make it past the first round. I've never won a trophy before. I'm glad this is my first time, and I had a lot of fun first in all the opponents I ended up having.
Leeton High's Jack Curry, ending that report by Nicola Saccato. Well, to a very different kind of school competition where kids from the bush compete in an age-old tradition, the noble art of bird calling. The Bornda Bird Olympics is now in its eighth year, revived from the 1950s, challenging students to do their best rendition of a native bird call. Adrian Reardon has more.
To the untrained ear, it might sound like you've walked into a forest filled with majestic Australian birds. But instead, you've stumbled into the Bornda Bird Olympics.
Kinsley. Kinsley is doing a kookaburra.
28 students from five schools are battling it out on the far south coast of New South Wales.
Hamish with a yellow-tailed black cockatoo.
From twitters and tweets to chirps and warbles, students are aiming to do their best impression of the call of a named species of bird.
I don't know, how does it sound to you fellas over there?
It's all right, Dad. There's a bit more quality this year, I think.
Very good quality, there you go.
10-year-old Otto West from Central Tilba took out this year's top prize.
We got Otto with the yellow-tailed black cockatoo. Beautiful. You just really nailed that there. That was fantastic. Well done.
This type of event was thriving in the 1950s, when school children on the far south coast would travel as far as Sydney to compete.
Here I am, and that would be 1954, I think.
83-year-old James Burton was one of the original bird callers.
I think we beat them about, I can't remember how many times, but about 8 years in a row, I think. They've still got the shield and that, I think, in Maroombilla. At the school.
In 2017, following renewed interest in the historic competition, the Bornda Environmental Education Centre worked with schools to revive the contest.
What makes a good bird call, Jim?
Good practice, good listening. You know, when we were young and that, there was heaps of birds around, and I spent a lot of time in the bush as a kid because you didn't have the phones and what they got today. You listened to birds, you could get the different sounds.
Well, I would think the yellow-tailed black cockatoo must be terribly hard. They all perfected it. I hate to think what their lungs and their throats are doing.
Barbara Jones is from the Far South Coast Birdwatchers Association and one of two judges presiding over the Bornda Bird Olympics. She's thrilled to see the tradition carried on.
It's lovely, and I wish more schools would be able to do it. I think they're very lucky that they have to have it. They must have a teacher, obviously, who's interested in nature.
Give us what you got. Good job, Casey.
Some of those sounds are very Halloween. Adrian Reardon with that report. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Home invasions, stabbings, carjackings. In Victoria, there's been a wave of serious and violent crimes. But is it right to label Melbourne the crime capital of Australia? Today, ABC Melbourne Mornings presenter Raphael Epstein. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.